Once again, I'd like to thank all those who are able to make it out once again this evening. As always, I'd like to encourage everyone to take out their Bibles and follow along so that hopefully by the end of this message we can all take something away from it. Now, in January 2003, actress Patricia Heaton, co-star of the popular television show Everybody Loves Raymond, was scheduled to introduce a retrospective video clip segment at the annual American Music Awards. However, as she was sitting in the audience waiting to go on, she found herself getting angry. Everyone in the audience, as well as the national TV audience, was subjected to one lewd and crude innuendo after another. Through it all were 1970s rock celebrity Ozzy Osbourne and his family, the MCs of the show, seemingly trying to see just how often they could get bleeped. Becoming disgusted, Heaton got up and left without making her scheduled presentation. Afterwards, Heaton told the Cleveland Plain Dealer, "I'm no prude, but this was such a vulgar and disgusting show. What was passing for humor basically ranged from stupid to vulgar, and I just thought, I'm not going to be a part of this. So I walked out and said, get my car, I'm leaving. I really didn't know what I was getting into," Heaton added. "It felt like I was in the Roman Colosseum, and as far as I'm concerned, it was an affront to anyone with a shred of dignity, self-respect, and intelligence." Heaton says she's not expecting any repercussions from the decision, and if there is, she said, "Who cares?" Now, contrast that incident with what happened on a Southwest airline flight in the same year. You may or may not know that Southwest Airlines has no assigned seating aboard their planes. Passengers merely choose their own seats as they board the plane. Now, on this particular flight, a few of the passengers apparently had a little bit of difficulty settling on their seats. So the flight attendant got on the plane's PA system and announced, "Eeny, meeny, miny, mo, pick a seat, we gotta go." Now, most of the passengers chuckled at the rhyme. But two sisters who were on the plane, who happened to also be black, felt that they were being discriminated against because people thought they were too dumb to find a seat. Later, they decided to sue Southwest Airlines because "Eeny, meeny, miny, mo," which now continues to catch a tiger by the toe, originally used a racial slur in place of the reference to the tiger. Of course, if the Southwest attendant had used a racial slur, then these women would have had reason to be upset. That kind of language is unacceptable. But there is no evidence that she was doing anything other than being lighthearted. In fact, Southwest Airlines has a policy of cultivating humor as a trademark. And an article in the Wall Street Journal on February 12, 2003 summed it up this way: "Southwest is in trouble over children's rhyme, and it could cost them 9-10 a big fat hen." Now, when I came across these two news items, I was struck by the irony that comes to light when you compare them. In one instance, we see people being rude, crude, and downright disgusting in front of the whole nation, and only one celebrity out of the hundreds in attendance feels enough shame to do something about it. However, in another instance, words are spoken in complete innocence, yet the speaker of those words is being branded a racist, and the incident is deemed by a judge to be worth going to court over. The prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah 5:20, describes what I believe is happening in our culture. It says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." And the prophet Malachi said much the same thing in 2:17. He says, "You have wearied the Lord with your words. Yet you say, in what way have we wearied Him? In that you say, everyone who does evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and He delights in them." Our culture seems to have come to a place where the language we use in public, in private, on the street, in the store, and over the public airways is completely turned around and probably best described as messed up. Many of the things people say that others are offended by are ridiculous, like getting upset over a simple rhyme used in jest. But many of the things that people don't find the least bit offensive would have been unspeakable or to say or do even just a few years ago. Psychologists talk about a phenomenon they call habituation. And it's a good word to add to our vocabularies. Again, that word, habituation. It describes a process of becoming used to something that you initially find unpleasant or even intolerable. If you live in a residential area, for example, and your neighbor buys an old rusted out car and then puts it up on blocks in the street in front of his house, you're going to look at it and think, well, that sure is an eyesore. Maybe you'll try to do something about it to encourage him to move it. But if it's still there after a few weeks, you will not notice it as you go out to work every day. Then a year later, someone will be visiting your home and say, boy, that sure is an ugly car your neighbor has. And you'll say, well, I guess so, but I just really don't notice it anymore. He's had it there so long. At that point, you're habituated to it. What was once offensive now seems like it's just part of the scenery. It's been there forever. You're in the habit of seeing it there in front of his house. I believe we have become habituated to the crude, vulgar, and general misuse of language in nearly every part of our society. Back in 1972, comedian George Carlin was arrested for saying the seven words you can never say on TV. Today, those words are used liberally on the premium cable channels, and the networks always seem to be trying to play catch-up by slipping more and more of them into the shows every season. In fact, whenever a show is billed as being edgy or pushing the envelope, what you can bet that means is that it's going to contain more bad language, it's going to depict more immoral behavior, and it's going to show more skin than nearly every show that was before it. And it's not just TV shows and movies that are constantly assaulting us with profanity, vulgarity, and political correctness in place of truth. See, this garbage saturates almost every facet of our society. It's true that bad language has always been around, but it used to be confined largely to, you know, men-only environments, the locker room, the pool hall, the bar, you know, stuff like that. People used to watch their language around women and children, yet now people of all ages, both men and women, swear with no social inhibitions. And sad to say, most of the time, it's the women and children that are the worst offenders. I know personally, after I quit playing football, I'd go back sometimes, you know, and go watch the games or whatever. And I'd pass groups of teenagers. And some of the things they'd be saying, you'd think, where are your parents? And why are you speaking like that? It's just terrible. It's not just the curse words they use. It's also the context of what they're talking about. You know, a few years ago, people knew if an adult, any adult, it didn't have to be your parents, teacher, older person, if you saw someone like that get within earshot, you better tone down the volume, the content, or both. It could be pretty bad at times, but even the worst offender knew that what they were doing was wrong, and they didn't want to be overheard. However, many people of all ages nowadays seem to have lost any sense of shame in regards to the language that they use. That is the state of our world. And while it may seem good to vent and gripe about it from time to time, we're called to do more than merely point out sin. We're called to counteract it. Paul wrote, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." So we must ask ourselves, what should a Christian's response be to the misuse of words? I know that there are people using bad words or using good ones inappropriately, but what can I do? What should I do in response in regards to my words and my speech? James wrote a very practical, down-to-earth letter to the early Christians. In James chapter 3, verse 2 through 12, that's where we'll be tonight. James chapter 3, verse 2 through 12, he says this about the Christian speech, or the tongue, as he refers to it here. Now listen. In James chapter 3, verse 2 through 12. It says, "For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths, and that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature. And it is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessings and cursings. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus, no spring yields both salt water and fresh." Basically, James says two things here about the tongue, our primary speech organ. First, he says, it is inordinately powerful, especially in light of its relative size and lack of brute strength. James compares the tongue to a bit in a horse's mouth, which is used to steer the animal around. He also says the tongue is like the rudder of a ship, which when you think about it, the rudder on a ship isn't very big, but it's able to steer that whole thing. James further tells us that the tongue is like the spark that comes at just the wrong place and time so that it starts a fire that burns down an entire forest or town. Secondly, James reminds us that the tongue is unstable. It's just as liable to get us into trouble and be an agent of sin as it is to be a means of which to do God's will. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea, is tamed by, and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. James said, "Thus no spring yields both salt water and fresh." The tongue is an unstable source of great power. Don't trust it. A man was working in a produce department, a grocery store. And a lady came up and asked if she could buy a half head of lettuce. Now he replied, "A half a head of lettuce? Are you serious? God grows these things in whole heads and that's how we sell them." "You mean," she persisted, "that after all the years I've shopped here, you won't sell me half a head of lettuce?" "Now look," he said, "if you like, I'll go ask the manager." And she said she would like him to ask. So the young man marched to the front of the store and he found the manager. And he said, "You won't believe this. Some idiot of a lady back there wants to know if she can buy half a head of lettuce." Now he noticed that the manager kind of gesturing behind him. And he turned around to see that the lady standing right there behind him, obviously having followed him to the front of the store. Without missing a beat, he gestured and said, "And this lovely lady was wondering if she could buy the other half." Later in the day, the manager cornered the young man. He said, "That was the best, finest example of thinking on your feet I've ever seen. Where'd you learn that?" Young man said, "You know, I grew up in Grand Rapids, and if you know anything about Grand Rapids, you know it's known for two things. It's great hockey team, and it's ugly women." The manager face flushed and he interrupted the man's explanation and said, "My wife's from Grand Rapids." Again, without missing a beat, the young man replied, "And which hockey team did she play for?" You don't need to be very old to have experienced a time in your life when your tongue has got you into trouble. I'm sure all of us have either seen or have had such a thing happen to us, like I just told you about. Your words, what you said, got you into trouble. What James warns us about is very applicable to all of us. Not only is the tongue powerful, but it's also unstable. With your words, you can praise those around you, causing them to reach and accomplish things they would have never tried before. Or you can discourage them and cause them to do so much less than what they are capable of. As children, you might recite, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But the truth is that on a very real level, that adage just isn't true. I couldn't tell you every cut and bruise that I've had in my life except for the ones that may have left scars. But I could tell you a lot of things that have been said to me that have been really painful, and I remember them to this day. Broken bones almost always heal. But I've known people who've suffered for years because of something hurtful that was said to them or what they said to someone. Every time we open our mouths, we have a choice. We can build up or we can tear down. We can encourage those around us to do good or trigger a bad response in people. We can say something that glorifies God or utter words that betray our stated allegiance to Him. James' warnings regarding the use of our tongues is there for us to keep in mind. But let me also give you three simple, quick guidelines for speaking that will help you. And if you practice them, it'll be part of the solution. And you won't be a part of the problem anymore. First, speak plainly. Psalms 34, verse 13 gives us this very simple advice. Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Godly people need to have a reputation for simply saying what they are going to do and then doing it. We shouldn't use certain words to try and give us an easy way to back out of commitments or give us some wiggle room that lets us weasel out of the consequences of the words we utter. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is speaking to the people about the tendency of the religious and devout people of that day to phrase everything they said. Now, when you're a kid, you ever make a promise to do something and then you didn't do it, and then someone came back to you and said, "Well, why didn't you do this?" "Well, I have my fingers crossed behind my back." The self-proclaimed godly people of Jesus' day were like that. They had rules about which promises they needed to keep and which ones they could break. Imagine conversation. Come up and say, "Well, I'm sorry, but I cannot pay the price we agreed upon for your grain." "Well, what? But you gave me your word." "Yeah, but you see, I swore by the temple, but that's not binding. If I had sworn by the gold of the temple, then I would be bound before God to honor our agreement." That was the kind of stuff that they went through. It was not all that far removed from our culture today when people enter into contracts and they have lawyers go over them and kind of give them little loopholes to be able to get through out of later. Jesus said of that kind of behavior, "But let your yes be yes and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one." It's not likely that our society will decide to reform in this area. But you know what? We can be people who speak plainly and then simply do what we said we were going to do. If your spouse asks you to do something around the house, you say, "Okay, I'll take care of it." Then do it. Don't wait until it's too late and say, "Well, I never said when I'd do it." Don't argue over what words mean. Everybody here knows what "is" means, even if we cannot give a dictionary definition. If you commit to doing something, then follow through with it. Then if, because of unforeseen circumstances, you cannot fulfill your commitment, talk to the person and simply say, "Well, I'm sorry, but this is what happened, and I just can't do what I said I would do." Don't make excuses or make up a lie. Just tell the truth. "This is why I couldn't do this." It may make you look bad for a time, but that's a whole lot better than being found out in a lie or being known as a person who never does what he said he'd do. And maybe, after a few incidents like that, it'll make you think twice before overcommitting yourself next time something like that comes up. If someone asks you to do something for them, give them an appropriate consideration and then be straight with them. "Well, sure, I can help you." Or, "No, I'm sorry, I can't." Or even, "I could help, but I don't feel comfortable, and here's why." Much of the time, we don't like to be direct and really tell people about our misgivings. But as uncomfortable as that may be, it is the best way to go in the long run. Let your yes mean yes, and your no-no. Let's speak plainly and directly to people. Second, speak boldly. And Ecclesiastes 12:11 says, "The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of the scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd." Now, I talked earlier about how many people seem to swear and curse indiscriminately. Now, it doesn't matter if a small child is walking by with her great-great-grandmother. They will still let loose with a blue streak. Sometimes it seems like that type of thing does not offend most people. However, I don't believe that's the case a lot of times. I believe it does offend people. People don't like hearing foul language. They're just too afraid to speak up and say anything about it. We don't go around casually imposing our wills on others, but we do end up having their wills imposed on us. If people want to talk that way, it's a free country, and they can find somewhere to do so, but there is no good reason why we should have to put up with it. Christian recording artist Randy Stonehill had a song called "Angry Young Men," in which he sang the line, "Rest assured that when Jesus comes again, He'll be looking for some angry young men." Now, I think we need more angry young men, angry older men, even angry women and children of all ages to be goads, to encourage people to behave better in public. I mean, we'll have a hissy fit if someone cuts in front of us in line at the grocery store, or if we can smell a cigarette smoke in a restaurant. So maybe we need to be willing to politely but firmly ask people to watch their language when they're speaking inappropriately in mixed company. I mean, if two people can sue over a modified children's rhyme, why can't we simply say, "Excuse me, but I'd appreciate it if you'd not use that kind of language around me and my kids." And finally, don't forget to temper the truth we speak with both love and grace. Like I said earlier, sometimes people say terribly hurtful things to or about others. And when they're called on it, they'll say, "Well, it was only the truth." Someone brought this type of scenario up to Ann Landers once, and she replied that truthfulness and frankness were not necessarily the same thing. We are always supposed to be truthful, but we should not be completely frank all the time and blurt out all the truth that we know. The Bible tells us in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15, to speak the truth in love. And Paul further urged in Colossians 4, 6, "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each other." A person can go around spouting all sorts of things that they believe are true. "Well, that outfit's terrible. The light off your forehead's too bright. The food you made, that was barely edible. That sermon was terrible." However, much of what we call truth is nothing more than our opinion, dressed up in pious garb. And even if it is true, that does not mean that we need to say it, or that it needs to be said at that time. Pianist Arthur Rubinstein was fluent in 8 languages, and he once told this story on himself. Some years ago, he was assailed by a stubborn case of hoarseness. Now, the newspapers were full of reports about smoking and cancer, so he decided to consult a throat specialist. Now, I searched his face for a clue during the 30-minute examination, Rubinstein said, but it was expressionless. He told me to come back the next day. I went home full of fears, and I did not sleep that night. The next day, there was another long examination, and again, an ominous silence. "Tell me," the pianist exclaimed, "I can stand the truth. I've lived a full, rich life. What's wrong with me?" The physician looked at him and said simply, "You talk too much." You know, we need to temper the truth we speak with grace and love. And sometimes the best way to do that is to simply be quiet. Our world is sold out to sin. We must never forget that. One of the ways this plays out is in the way the world uses language. We, as Christians, are called to counteract that worldly sinfulness. In our effort to do so, let us realize the power and danger in failing to control what we say. And then let us speak plainly, boldly, and temper the truth with love and grace. The lesson is now yours, and the invitation is now extended. If you're here this evening and not yet a Christian, take this time that we've given to you. Hear, believe, repent, confess, be baptized. Don't waste the opportunity. If you are here, you are a Christian, haven't been living your life the way you should, come forward. We'll pray with you and for you as together we stand and sing.